We've come to Leviticus chapter 20. Chapter 19, which we considered last Lord's Day evening, was a selection of laws based more or less on the Ten Commandments. Chapter 18, before it, was a long list of laws, most of which dealt with whom it was permissible to have a sexual relationship, always in marriage, of course. This chapter concerns the proper punishment for various crimes against God and man. The repetition of many of the laws found in chapter 18 serves to emphasize their importance. Idolatrous worship and sexual sin were principal forms of Israel's later apostasy. Now, in the modern West, where the entire theory of retributive punishment has come into question, readers of the Bible can struggle to appreciate what they find in a chapter like the one we are about to read. It can seem to the modern reader horribly primitive, even barbaric. It will not sound so even today in many other cultures, but it does in ours. But we'll do well to withhold our judgment until we have considered carefully what is taught in the chapter, compare it to what was common among other peoples of that time and place, and to what we are doing today ourselves. So, Leviticus chapter 20. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Say to the people of Israel, any one of the people of Israel or of the strangers who sojourn in Israel who gives any of his children to Molech shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I myself will set my face against that man and will cut him off from among his people because he has given one of his children to Molech to make my sanctuary unclean and to profane my holy name." Now, one thing we must not do as we listen to the word of God from Leviticus 20 is to fail to take with complete seriousness what it is we read. In a close-knit community, as Israel would have been in the days of the wilderness and thereafter, to stone another person to death would have been extraordinarily difficult to do. It would be a difficult thing enough to participate in a stoning, even if the person to be executed was a stranger to you and had committed a horrific crime. But to execute someone you knew, someone you might even be related to in the clan, must have been a terrible trial. These people had the same sensibilities that you and I have, a fact to which the entire Bible bears its own witness. They were more extended family-oriented than we are. Such punishment was hard to execute, hard to have a hand in. But so reprehensible was the crime of child sacrifice, the murder of a little boy or girl, for the purpose of gaining some advantage with some so-called God, so utterly without excuse was it, and so vicious, that the death penalty was the only adequate punishment. Premeditated murder, which this certainly was, always deserved capital punishment in the Bible. And the Lord insisted that his people execute that punishment, that they be involved, that they know what it was, who had done what, and why he was being put to death. It should also be noted that stoning was the ordinary form of judicial execution in Israel. It was not the work of a mob, but was under the control of the court that had pronounced sentence. Witnesses against the man, if you remember from Deuteronomy, were required to cast the first stone, another way of ensuring that they would have told the truth in the trial. But the community could not pass this responsibility to others. Punishment was both institutional and personal in Israel. It should be noted also in verse 3, the punishment inflicted by the court was ipso facto the Lord's punishment of the sinner. A small nation that absolutely depended upon the protection of the Lord could ill afford to offend him or drive him away. And if the people of the land do at all close their eyes to that man when he gives one of his children to Molech, and do not put him to death, then I will set my face against that man and against his clan, and will cut them off from among their people, him and all who follow him in whoring after Molech. If the people refuse to carry out the punishment for whatever reason, they would be themselves conniving in the sin, and they too would suffer its just punishment. The Lord promised to see to it himself if they refused. If you remember, child sacrifice during the reign of the northern kings, and especially Manasseh in the south, was a principal cause of the destruction of Israel by the Assyrians first, and then of Judah by the Babylonians. So a great many Jews would, in fact, eventually lose their lives in punishment for conniving in these very sins. If a person turns to mediums and necromancers, whoring after them, I will set my face against that person and will cut him off from among his people. Now again, as we said last time, divination in all its forms, and these are forms of divination, an attempt to learn what the gods intended to do in the future so that you could adjust your plans accordingly, was regarded as a vicious crime against God's covenant. Divination is, in all its forms, a form of magic, another word for superstition. It's another particularly crude form of idolatry, as if there are other powers in this world that we need to mollify or need to consult in order to live our lives acceptably before God and one another. The death penalty for such a crime is not stipulated here in verse 6, but it is later at the end of the chapter in verse 27. All of the sins mentioned in this part of the chapter are to be punished with death. Consecrate yourselves, therefore, and be holy, for I am the Lord your God. Keep my statutes and do them. I am the Lord who sanctifies you. As in previous chapters, these laws and their sanctions rest on the authority of Yahweh himself. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, in effect, means Yahweh called Israel into fellowship with himself precisely so that they might be a people who live a holy life. When they betray that calling, it is a particularly egregious form of rebellion, particularly inexcusable, given the Lord's grace and mercy to an undeserving people like Israel. For anyone who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. He has cursed his father or his mother. His blood is upon him. Now, in the context of the whole law of Moses, what is referred to as cursing one's father or mother, better dishonoring them, is not the ordinary disobedience of children that parents must reprove and correct, but an adult who is both defying his parents, their wishes and their interests, which are assumed to be appropriate and righteous, but is abusing his parents. In the parallel section in Deuteronomy, the person in view is also a drunk and a glutton. What is in view then is the worst form of rebellion, a profound, dangerous subverting of the social order. The parallel text in Deuteronomy also reminds us that, as in all these other cases, a court would actually hear the case, weigh the evidence, render the verdict, decide whether or not this particular crime deserved punishment. This was not a mob taking justice into its own hands. The way the crime is described here reminds us that all the crimes mentioned in the chapter are typically the worst forms of a particular class of offenses. If a man commits adultery with the wife of his neighbor, both the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. In other words, the adultery was consensual. She's called an adulteress because she was a willing participant. Victims of rape in the law of Moses were never regarded as guilty of a sexual sin, as they are all too commonly today in some cultures. If a man lies with his father's wife, he has uncovered his father's nakedness. Both of them shall surely be put to death. Their blood is on them. Such behavior was both adultery and incest. If a man lies with his daughter-in-law, both of them shall surely be put to death. They have committed perversion. Their blood is upon them. As perhaps you've already recognized, we're treating a list of sexual sins that violate the bonds of family, just as that long list of sins in Leviticus chapter 18 were characterized as violating the bonds of family. If a man lies with a male as with a woman, both of them have committed an abomination. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. If a man takes a woman and her mother also, by the way, their blood is upon them, is another way of saying that they deserve death, and we'll encounter that phrase again. If a man takes a woman and her mother also, it is depravity. He and they shall be burned with fire, that there may be no depravity among you. The presumption is in the verb takes is that this man is married to both a woman and her mother. Burned with fire could be a more severe form of execution reserved for particularly revolting sins. However, it may not be the form of execution, death by burning, but the burning of the body after stoning, a practice of which we read several times in the Old Testament. There would be no burial, obviously, again, a greater disgrace in those days than in ours. If a man lies with an animal, he shall surely be put to death, and you shall kill the animal. If a woman approaches any animal and lies with it, you shall kill the woman and the animal. They shall surely be put to death. Their blood is upon them. If a man takes his sister, a daughter of his father or a daughter of his mother, and sees her nakedness, and she sees his nakedness, it is a disgrace, and they shall be cut off in the sight of the children of their people. He has uncovered his sister's nakedness, and he shall bear his iniquity. Now, it's not entirely clear to us why certain marital violations were not considered as serious as others. But marriage with a half-sister here, with an uncle's wife in verse 19, and with a woman who had been formerly married to one's brother, verse 21, were in this category of sins that did not deserve the death penalty. Here the penalty is being cut off from the people. It isn't easy to prove from the text what the term cut off means, but all in all, scholars think it means it's best to assume that it means to be exiled, banished, excommunicated from the assembly. The guilty person would be forced to leave the community in the nature of the case, forced to leave his family and his extended family as well, an especially heavy burden in those days. If a man lies with a woman during her menstrual period and uncovers her nakedness, he has made naked her fountain, and she has uncovered the fountain of her blood. Both of them shall be cut off from among their people. Now, when we considered this law in chapter 15:24 and in 18:19, we made a point of saying we're not talking about the inadvertent discovery that a period had begun, but contempt for the requirement of maintaining ritual purity before the Lord as God's people. Again, the activity is presumed to be consensual. Both of these people are simply flaunting the holiness of God and the holiness that God's people must preserve in his presence. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your mother's sister or of your father's sister, for that is to make naked one's relative. They shall bear their iniquity. If a man lies with his uncle's wife, he has uncovered his uncle's nakedness. They shall bear their iniquity. They shall die childless. The penalty in this case is imposed by the Lord himself, not the court, perhaps because a paternal uncle's wife was not considered as close a relative. Again, all of this is going to have made immediate sense to the people who heard it first, even though we may struggle to understand all the nuances from this distance. If a man takes his brother's wife, it is impurity. He has uncovered his brother's nakedness. They shall be childless. You shall therefore keep all of my statutes and all of my rules and do them, that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. Again, these are not theoretical temptations. The practices that are being forbidden in chapters 18 and 20 were commonplace among Israel's neighbors. They were practiced without thought and without comment in Israel's culture. And you shall not walk in the customs of the nation that I am driving out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I detested them. But I have said to you, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has separated you from the peoples. Now, we're used to flowing with milk and honey as a description of the fruitfulness of the land of Canaan. But lest anybody not exactly understand why, the phrase suggests a land capable of supporting large herds and flocks from which the milk came, and thick with fruit trees, especially the date palm from which most honey was produced. You shall therefore separate the clean beast from the unclean and the unclean bird from the clean. You shall not make yourselves detestable by beast or by bird or by anything with which the ground crawls, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine. Now, in those last three verses, this is a new twist on the clean-unclean distinction we've already discussed earlier in the book of Leviticus. Here the Lord says that his people are clean. He has made them clean. And he has in that way divided them from the unclean world. Therefore, they should demonstrate the distinction between them and others by carefully observing the distinction between clean and unclean animals. And in fact, he's saying the Canaanites lost the promised land because they were unclean. But the same thing would happen to Israel should she take lightly her calling to be a holy people before the Lord. In other words, here, the reference to clean and unclean animals, which seems alien to the theme of the chapter as a whole, is used as an analogy. The moral distinction between clean and unclean should be uppermost in Israel's mind. She was to remain clean before God, like the clean animals. And if she didn't, she would suffer the same fate as the Canaanites, who had become unclean, which, alas, she eventually did. A man or woman who is a medium or a necromancer shall surely be put to death. They shall be stoned with stones. Their blood shall be upon them. The chapter, as others in Leviticus, is organized chiastically, which explains why we have another reference at the end of the chapter to mediums and necromancers. Some emphasis is being put on this, obviously, in part because these forms of divination were so common in the rest of the ancient world. Not just among the peoples that Israel was rubbing shoulders with, but certainly in Greece, everyone wanted to go to Delphi at some point or another to get a prophecy from the oracle there to find out what was going to happen in the future. To turn to fortune-telling was virtually the same thing as turning to idols. It represented a repudiation of covenantal faith and life and a resort to its opposite, magic. Magic in its more serious form, not magic as entertainment as we know it today, but magic as religious practice, is any practice thought to have the power to manipulate forces of the world without regard to ethics, without regard to moral living. In Yahweh's world, in the world of God's covenant, ethics is what matters. Faith and righteousness are what he rewards. Faith and righteousness are the way to live your life wisely and well in this world. Not some procedure imagined to manipulate some imagined gods or fates in some way. So far, than the Word of God. Leviticus 20 continues, obviously, the emphasis on Israel's holiness and holiness of life that was begun in chapter 18. You will have noticed once again the connection that is assumed throughout this material between pagan religious practices and sexual degeneracy. We're observing that connection in our own time. The loss of the biblical view of God has set loose every manner of sexual license, and we've become, in a remarkably short time, as sexually corrupt a people as has ever existed on the face of the earth. It's really astonishing. If you know history, you realize this is true. Once again, we come face to face with the loss of a perspective that long defined the moral stance of the Christian West, however imperfectly. It was agreed by almost everyone that there was a moral order. A moral order that was fixed in nature itself and in the nature of human beings, men and women, boys and girls in particular. A moral order to which all human beings were obliged to submit. This was reality itself, and it couldn't be ignored without moral fault on the one hand and without harm being done to the human family on the other. That conviction was itself built on the conviction that the living God had created the world, had imprinted His will on the conscience of mankind, had built a moral order into the world itself, and would not permit that order to be flaunted without consequence. Indeed, without horrific consequence. It was never thought until just our own day that promiscuity resulted in disease, or that sexual sins of various kinds destabilized the family or were profoundly harmful to children as an accident. It was the nature of the world. It was the moral order built into that nature. In the same way, it was taken as a matter of course that both homosexuality and bestiality were unnatural deviations from the divinely created order of human life. As this view of God, of creation, and the moral order has withered away almost to nothing in the West, interestingly, however, only in some ethical areas, sex supremely, the assumption seems to be that one can pick and choose which dimensions of this fixed moral order can be eliminated while keeping the rest. I say, but as this concept of a fixed moral order has been lost to the Western mind, sexual license has flourished apace. Indeed, it's not too much to say that abortion, our modern form of Molech worship, and all forms of sex detached from marriage are the index of the sea change in the ruling moral philosophy of the modern West. Some important advocates of this revolution in moral philosophy have admitted as much. It was the desire for sexual freedom from the constraints of that presumed moral order that was the great motive of the revolution in thought and philosophy. In a single generation, we have become entirely used to millions of abortions, a culture of pornography, a culture of promiscuity and the trivialization of sex as entertainment, a form of recreation. It's a great experiment, this, whether a society, any society, can survive, much less thrive, built on such a moral foundation. The evidence accumulating as we speak is not encouraging. The increasing number of adults who are remaining unmarried and likely will remain unmarried, falling birth rates, the difficulty American adults are finding in creating stable relationships with the opposite sex, pornography is a new form of addiction, the growing instability of families, the ever-increasing measures of psychological pain in the lives of both children and adults, these are omens of greater trouble ahead, not of some new world of personal liberation in which everyone finds true fulfillment in the satisfaction of whatever sexual desires might move him or her at the moment. The world was not built to work that way. And the truth of God's law is nowhere more profoundly demonstrated than in the misery that eventuates when it is disobeyed. Judgment may not come overnight. It didn't in Israel's case. But come it will. It always has, and the signs of coming doom are already visible everywhere one looks. So perhaps we 21st century Americans are not the ones to be carping at the punishments listed in Leviticus 20. There is a price to be paid by somebody, a terrible price in human woe and death, when such sins are allowed, when they go unpunished, and in many cases in our modern world, come to be celebrated. If you don't think so, ask the Canaanites. Oh, you can't. They don't exist. They haven't for thousands of years. If you young people are wondering, as you may be, what the big deal is about homosexual marriage, why it should be thought so wrong and so dangerous, begin here to think your way to the bottom of this question. The advocacy of homosexual marriage proceeds and must proceed on the assumption that there is no moral order built into human life, no moral reality to which all human beings are subject because of its rootedness, because of its foundation in the very nature of things. It cannot admit that there is such a thing as a perversion or an abomination because such a practice is contrary to nature. If it matters not that men and women were made for each other, that their sexual complementarity is a foundation of human life, and if homosexuality is as perfectly natural as heterosexuality, it will be, frankly, impossible to argue that anything is intrinsically wrong. It will certainly be impossible to argue that bestiality is wrong or incest is wrong if someone wants to or chooses to practice. If we deny that the relationship between a parent and a child is by nature of a morally unique kind, we can hardly argue that incest is forbidden. More than that, we have left the ground upon which we might raise an argument that the Muslim jihadists who wish to kill all Christians and Jews are doing something intrinsically wrong. He is quite sure he ought to do what he is doing. You don't want him to, but you cannot argue that what he is doing is objectively and absolutely wrong. Not if you have already come to terms with abortion and euthanasia. Not if you no longer can say that human life is sacred in its very nature, as utterly distinct from and superior to all other forms of life. All you can say, literally, all you can say is that murder may be acceptable in some cultures, but it is not so far in ours. You've detached ethical norms from any universal foundation. And if history shows us anything, once so detached, a society's ethics will follow the path of least resistance downward. As the heroic German Lutheran pastor Martin Niemöller observed, first they came for the socialists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a socialist. Then they came for the trade unionists, and I didn't speak out because I was not a trade unionist. Then they came for the Jews, and I didn't speak out because I was not a Jew. And then they came for me, but there was no one left to speak for me. They will not admit that this is what they have done, but it is the easiest thing to demonstrate in a discussion with an unbeliever that this is precisely what they have done. And all you ever have to do is just raise the argument, why should we believe you and not the Muslim jihadist? And when they seek to answer that question, you're going to see with your own two eyes they have nothing to say. And we've not yet begun to consider what God himself might do when human beings rebel against his will and against the creation that he has made in such flagrant, obvious, and defiant ways. Name a culture in the history of mankind that has not suffered judgment when it has sought to build itself on a foundation of indifference to these fundamental laws of God that he has woven into the fabric of human existence. The family is the bedrock of any and every human society. When families break down, the society itself will not be far behind. And what the modern sexual revolution has done is to break down the family, whether by making marriage unnecessary, or by producing immense numbers of children out of wedlock, or by increasing the incidence of divorce, or by identifying other relationships as family that are not rooted in the nature of a family as God made the family to be, and so profoundly redefining the family as something other than an artifact, a hard reality of human nature as God made it, making it instead one of a number of social constructions, human inventions, if you will, that we can tinker with as we please. No man invented the family. It was here at the very beginning of human life, and history demonstrates that powerfully. The severe penalties prescribed for certain sins here in Leviticus 20 demonstrate how seriously the Lord takes those sins, how important it was to put Israel on guard against them, because the consequence of them was the unraveling of Israel's social life. Nothing is so likely to deter as the threat of punishment. Now, that principle is very often denied nowadays. You hear it denied all the time. Its denial is perfectly predictable. When a society rebels against the law of nature, it must assure itself that there will be no consequences for its rebellion. It may be whistling in the dark, but one must whistle when one is afraid of what mayhem may be hiding there in the darkness. And so it is often asserted that punishment does not deter. But that's absurd. I hope we all know that's absurd. We know very well, we check our speedometers, we drop our foot off the accelerator when we see a police car ahead, precisely because we do not want to get a ticket. When the police go on strike, we can predict there will be looting. The punishment of children in every well-ordered family proceeds on the assumption that children who learn that punishment follows misbehavior will learn by that means not to misbehave. Most capital crimes are committed by people who expect somehow to remain undetected and unpunished. Of course, punishment doesn't deter everyone. That's why punishments are devised. But punishment justly and swiftly applied has a tremendous deterrent effect on societies as wholes. The Greeks, if you've been reading your newspaper, the Greeks have stopped paying their taxes. Why? Because they know no one is going to punish them for having done so. Punishment is essential to human life. It's essential to social order. But what punishments? Well, note these facts about punishment in the law of Moses. First, in some important respects, it was very different from that prescribed in other ancient Near Eastern law codes. There is a human, even a humanitarian focus in the law of Moses that is distinctive among those ancient law codes. In Israel, crimes against humanity were more serious than crimes against property. Crimes against property were never capital crimes in Israel, though they were often capital crimes in other ancient Near Eastern codes. Also, there was in Israel no regard for class or status. In Mesopotamian law, for example, an injury to a nobleman was punished much more severely than an injury to a commoner. In Israel, even aliens and immigrants were treated equally under the law. Finally, the law of Moses did not permit substitutionary punishment, as did the other law codes. No one was ever punished for crimes that were committed by somebody else. Second, there's a debate in biblical scholarship as to whether the punishments listed in chapter 20 were required in every case, or whether they were the maximum penalties allowed for that particular class of crime. It seems to me likely that idolatry and murder were always capital crimes in Israel, but for the others, there is at least some evidence that what we have in some cases are the legally permissible maximum penalties, and that mitigating factors may have reduced sentences, even significantly, in some cases. Third, the principal form of punishment in modern states in the West for a wide variety of crimes is absolutely absent from the law of Moses and the law of God. Scripture mentions prisons in Egypt, Philistia, Assyria, and Babylon. Later evil kings of Israel cast their opponents into prison, and we read of Jewish and Roman prisons in the New Testament, but the law of Moses never mentions imprisonment as a punishment for crime. Crimes punished by imprisonment today were punished by beating, by the requirement of restitution, by slavery, by banishment, and by capital punishment. The dismal failure of our prison system in the United States, the horrific recidivism rates, on average 75%, three-quarters or more of American prisoners reoffend and return to prison. The dehumanizing aspects of prison life have now led many thoughtful observers to argue that imprisonment has proved a dismal failure and that our reliance on it should be rethought. A fundamental mistake. Perhaps we're not as forward-thinking or as humane as we imagine ourselves to be. American prisons are moral sewers, training grounds in crime. They destabilize personalities rather than fix them. Nations that use public beatings as punishment for certain crimes have a much lower crime rate than we do. Similarly, restitution is a form of punishment, the requirement that the offender pay back and more the victim for the harm done, affirms the moral seriousness of human behavior, directly and positively addresses the harm that was done, and provides the offender with a much more hopeful way forward. We would not, of course, think it right for the modern state to enforce laws against idolatry or blasphemy. It shouldn't be illegal for there to be a horoscope in your newspaper. The United States is not a nation in covenant with God. It would be incompetent to assess such behavior or to define the crime. On the other hand, that's far from saying the United States will not suffer divine judgment for the crimes it is committing against God and man these days. The laws of Leviticus 18 and 20 are laws for all mankind. They are the laws of God. They're the laws that God has woven into the fabric of human life. They're not just laws for believers. The fact is, the punishment for sin is built into the fabric of the universe. We Christians should be the last to deny this insofar as our redemption from sin and death required the punishment of the Son of God himself. What was the cross but punishment for sin, borne on our behalf by the Lord Jesus? Nor can we deny that punishment very often has a salutary effect in human life, correcting the behavior of some and warning others away from doing what is wrong. It's the threat of punishment that solemnizes human life. Without it, it would not be nearly as solemn an affair as it is. As C.S. Lewis famously observed, God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, shouts in our pains. What we're given in chapter 20, which may seem laborious reading to a modern American evangelical, is a window on the nature of the world. What is required to keep human wickedness in bounds? A dying civilization such as ours should be the very last to imagine that it has somehow found a better way, a more humane way, a more just way. Neither calling evil good nor boasting of its moral enlightenment will indemnify a society against the judgments of the Lord. It may refuse to punish, but as we read in verse 5, God will do what man will not. The inconsistency and hypocrisy of the modern American position is, of course, that it wishes to excuse certain behaviors while at the same time expecting society to respect other moral imperatives and norms. But the law of nature, the law God imprinted both on the world and on the conscience and heart of mankind, is a seamless robe. Pull out any thread and the entire garment must begin to unravel. If there's no authority lying behind our ethics, if there is no sanction, if our moral code comes to be thought of as simply a man-made device by which we manipulate public behavior, that code will prove no match for the lusts of the flesh. Why should I care about someone else's mere opinion when his opinion would limit my freedom to do as I please? So many deeply troubling features of American sexual life are now, alas, impossible to talk about publicly, precisely because we can no longer admit that sex is so much more than an innocent, natural act for the sake of the mutual exchange of pleasure. Sex is, on the contrary, an extraordinarily powerful, life-creating, soul-defining act, and in its unique intimacy draws the entire personality into itself. It can be trivialized only to the great peril of the human soul and body. It is in its very nature one of the most monumental of human activities, full of wonderful potential and terrible risk. Human societies have, generally speaking, understood this through the ages. For that reason, they surrounded the sexual dimension of life with rigid protections and limitations, such as we find here in Leviticus 20. The fact is that contemporary sexual practice and sexual expression is destroying vast multitudes of human lives in the modern West, denaturing them, visiting upon them varieties of psychological and social distress and dysfunction. And the society knows this, but it will not and cannot talk about it, because to do anything about it, really to do something, would be to admit that there is, in fact, a moral order built into human life to which all human beings must be subject. So be it. But at least let's not have any of this silliness about our living in a more enlightened age. And still more, we Christians should at least have the sense not to jump on this bandwagon just as it is sinking irretrievably into the quagmire. These ancient punishments tell us what God thinks about what we are doing in our culture today. If we believe in God, if we believe in the truth of His Word, if we believe that He judges the wicked and rewards the righteous, if we will never, ever accept as normal what He has taught us to regard as a perversion, as an abomination, as a disgrace. Leviticus 20 is, to be sure, not one of the happiest chapters in the Bible, but the testimony it bears, the truth it conveys, is absolutely fundamental to any honest view of the world and any possibility of a healthy human society, given the human heart. We are not, as Christians, only interested in our own salvation and that of others that we know. We should care about the world and the people of the world. Who knows better than the Creator of heaven and earth how human life ought to be lived. Amen.